assistant rabbi.
And specifically rabbi, I think.
Yeah, well, a rabbi who was in another position, Howard, Rabbi Howard Kaplansky, was interested, and I indicated that this looked appropriate. And Rabbi Stateman was also interested. So I brought them both here, and they met with the board, which must be a bit of an ordeal. A young graduate suddenly comes into this room, 30-some-odd people who are asking questions. And I tried in each of these instances to make it as easy as possible and to see to it that if there was a question that seemed a little out of line, to reword it and rephrase it, give the person a bit of an opportunity to think about what they were going to say. Well, the board liked them both. And so we decided at that juncture that, as we were also looking for an educator, that Rabbi Kaplansky would come as an associate rabbi, because he had been an assistant already elsewhere, and that Rabbi Stateman would come as the head of the religious school, with some rabbinic involvement right from the very beginning.
He was coming, right? He was, had just
straight
graduated
from school. And then after 2 years, Rabbi Kaplansky left for his own pulpit in New England, in Springfield, Massachusetts, a very nice congregation, from which he went a couple of years after that to a large congregation in St. Louis. Each time he invited me to install him. Very, very fine and able man. Rabbi Stateman at that point moved from the position of religious school administrator as his primary role to an assistant rabbi without religious school primary responsibilities. He was succeeded in that position in the religious school by Rabbi Charles Levy, who remained for 2 years also, 2 or 3 years, I've forgotten that. After that, we returned in the religious school to a part-time administrator. At that point, the congregation had, the steel mills had shut. We had lost about 400 families over a period of 3 or 4 years. People who simply died or moved away and weren't replaced as nobody was moving to town. So we wanted to go from 3 rabbis to 2 rabbis. So this was a way of cutting back.
Could you give me a date?
I'd better give you those dates accurately another time so that they won't be guesses. It's before that we had a So then Rabbi Stateman and I, really for the next 20 years, ran the congregation together. And it certainly worked out extremely well. We've been friends through all the years and have essentially divided the work between us, straight down the middle, you might say, with everybody, both of us doing. That's worked out well, and the program continued to expand.
Now, in the meantime, in the last couple of years, we have two rabbis.
Right.
Why is it necessary now to expand again?
Well, this was, part of this was kind of funny, because when I was vice president and then president of the Central Conference of American Rabbis, and out of town a great deal. And Rabbi Staiglin was very active with the Soviet Jewry, a national body, not yet president, but very active with them. We are both gone. At that point, it would have made good sense to add a rabbi. And furthermore, the congregation had grown, and we were, again, up to 1,800 families. So it had become more and more difficult to do the heavy programming. The three services on the weekend, plus religious school, plus all the other things that you should do in the community, and to do it appropriately. But there was a reluctance to go to three rabbis, and it took some years of discussion. So the result was that all of this happened during my last year as president of the Central Conference, when it was still necessary as far as the growth of the congregation was concerned, but no longer as necessary as far as my personal involvement nationally was concerned. So we looked at both, in this case, I felt it was appropriate, as Mark and I had really split our duties, for both of us to go into it. And we did that in New York, we did it in Cincinnati, brought back three candidates for the congregation to board to interview, and they selected Debbie Pine, and we also found was the best of the three candidates. We realized when we engaged her that she had a husband who was studying for the rabbi and would graduate 2 years later, and felt that by that time something else would open up in Pittsburgh, either a congregation or in some other position. As it turned out, it didn't. So 2 years later, we were left with the question of, do we simply say goodbye and indicate that there's no need here for a fourth rabbi, and so we'll have to look someone new. We decided against that on two grounds. One is that we've never liked a lot of turnover. It really takes a couple of years before you feel at home and know people. And of course, Debbie was well liked and did things very well. And secondly, the feeling that it would be useful to try to expand the program, particularly in the direction of youth, young people. For that, you need the right person, and that Andy Bush, Rabbi Bush, would be the right person for that. So we moved in that direction, not entirely, because one or the other, I've forgotten which one, is really three-quarters time and pay. So I'm sure that has never been clear to the congregation, but it enabled us to move ahead in that direction. No, one is getting a full salary and the other is getting three-quarters,
okay.
Two-thirds salary, something like that.
Now, you mentioned something we have discussed, which I hadn't even thought about. Rabbi Staiglin is much too young to be interviewed for a number of years. I think we have to talk about the Soviet too. Well, is that way? That'll be history by the time he's in the moment. But
well,
I think it's important. Do you think it's important?
Sure. Well, let's do this in two phases. One is that the involvement of the congregation in Soviet Jewry, which began quite early, late 60s and early 70s, when the first wave of immigrants came over, the J general community, the broad community, really wasn't willing or ready or equipped to do much, and the United Jewish Federation. And so we decided this, a lot needed to be done, and we would simply do it. And so we organized families to be helpful. We saw to it that clothing, furniture, and so on was made available, and provided meeting places for the new immigrants to get together, and really did our best to resettle and help that first wave. A group of people who soon acculturated. They were very bright and very idealistic, and very interested in things too, which is a bit of a contrast to the next group of immigrants. This group has largely left Pittsburgh because when the mills closed and the job situation became tougher, they were the first laid off. Last hired, first fired, but by that time were acclimatized enough to be able to get pretty good positions themselves. And I stay in touch with some of them who have major positions on the East Coast and West Coast, occasionally come back to Pittsburgh. With the second wave of immigration, we of course played a much more minor role because now the community itself was geared up, and so we fed our volunteers and our people into that. Now, this has nothing to do particularly with Marx's efforts, because he became, before him, actually, Victor Cavalier was already involved in some international meetings to help Soviet Jews in the 60s at overseas. Brussels, a few other places. Mark became very interested in this work and became heavily involved. This was before the Soviet Union fell. Was on the board, became very close to some of the people who were the national president and national officers. Did a tremendous amount for the organization.
And he became president.
He became the national president a year ago. So this was in 1905.
What was the feeling for older members?
It was extremely supportive because we had done the same thing in the 50s for people who were fleeing the abortive Hungarian Revolution. And there was quite a wave of individuals who came. And we did our best to integrate them, to support them, and also to support some of them in ways that are rather humorous, especially in retrospect. There were a couple of painters, and so we decided to engage them, and they painted some pictures which are still hanging in some places in the building, really copies of Oppenheimer pictures from the 18th century and so on. But it was a way of giving them some useful work. They weren't the world's greatest artists, but it got them on their feet. No, this congregation has always been supportive. It didn't matter whether the immigrants came from Germany in the 30s and 40s or Hungary or later on Russia. You know, those kinds of antipathies which existed earlier toward Eastern European Jews had really, by the Second World War, dissipated. Later on, much later on, talk about the irony that those kinds of antipathies now exist in Germany, Eastern European Jews who came in the 50s, Eastern European Jews who are coming in the 90s. It's funny.
Well, that's
they just weren't set up for it and couldn't move very fast. But that's...
Is that because of bureaucracy?
Yes. You know, you've got a committee structure. There was really nothing. This had never been a port of entry.
Right.
And the number of people who came, let's say, in the 30s and 40s, were largely absorbed by families and by... with the help of two congregations, Rota Shalom and the Tree of Life. I don't think anybody else played any significant role. The Hungarian group was relatively small. We're talking about a few hundred individuals. And when this group came rather suddenly, in New York, of course, we have Hayas and so on, okay. They were ready, but we didn't have any. And, you know, for all the good things one can say about the Federation, it is not a group that is quickly jumps from one direction to another. It takes them a good while to adjust. We've always been able to move very rapidly because there's no bureaucracy here. You know, if the rabbi and the administrator decided this is a good direction, and you talk to a few board members, you get going, it's not going to cost anything, go ahead and do it, that's all. You know, this has also played a role, I might say, has nothing to do with the subject under discussion, in the Community Relations Council Board. When it was led by Lillian Friedberg, and that was for many decades, probably from the 50s on, it was independent, highly flexible, and she was able to give a home to a dozen, maybe 20 organizations that were just information, that needed an address, needed a telephone or something like that. When this organization became an arm of the United Jewish Federation, it ceased to have that flexibility.
Its home was here?
Oh no, its home was not here. Its home was independent. But she, because of her personality and the way she led this organization, was able to do this. When the same organization became a committee of the Federation, it now meant that before you did anything, you had to have a series of committee meetings, permissions, and so on and so forth. Same as far as Temple is concerned, happened with Horizon Homes, which I don't think we've talked about.
No. Do you want to talk about that?
Well, I just want to mention that for an instant, that for a year, I needed a home for this. Just a place to sit, for an administrator to sit, and a telephone. So I asked the president of the congregation, is this all right? He said yes. We put him up in the religious school office, which was not much in use during the week, except for Hebrew school, and it functioned in that way. So we've always been very flexible and able and willing to take chances, too.
I think this might be a good time to talk about
it. All right.
Well, then I'll tell you what. We'll wait till the next time to talk about Horizon. I still have a few cleaning up things. You had mentioned the religious school was available to children of special needs, and still would be if there were children of special needs.
Well,
do you have any right now?
No, it still is, but and we have some children with problems, but what we have not had in the last decade or so is a special class. We had for many years a class which dealt primarily with autistic and severely retarded children. And at the moment, we don't. And while other people have been mainstream, you know, we've had deaf children, blind children, mildly retarded children who have been part of.
Do they have helpers?
Sometimes, yeah, and what is easy there is that you know, we've got 11th and 12th graders who are teacher's assistants. So we can, if a helper is needed, we can almost always find a child who's appropriate to do that.
Would a blind child have this? Is there
a text in Braille? Yes. And both the blind children and the deaf children needed very little additional help. They got around quite well. And then, of course, we've had children all kinds of physical mobility problems. And the way around that is, as we have an elevator in the building, is simply to move the classes to such locations that that age group can get together at a place that's accessible.
One other cleanup. I hate to call it cleanup. You alluded early on to the difference Rehoff in his time and you in your time. And of course there was a time when Dr. Rehoff was chief rabbi, there was this great anti-science. What's a good word?
No, sure.
Prior to establishment.
Sure, well that really occurred before I came. This is the American Council for Judaism. The previous rabbi here, Samuel Goldenson, was one of the supporters of that anti-Zionist group. So individuals who felt close to him joined that group and eventually formed a small subgroup here in the city, some in temple, some outside the temple. Dr. Frioff's policy, and I think it was a wise one, was not to make much of a fuss about them. Those that dropped out, let them drop out. Those that stayed, let them stay and express their opinions. And the only time that he indicated that we would not go in the direction they suggested was when there was when some of the individuals said we should not make Hebrew part of our mandatory curriculum. And that was probably one of the rare times that he went to a religious school committee meeting and indicated that as long as he was rabbi of this congregation, Hebrew would be taught in the religious school. And that was the end of that discussion. And although in those years before we had Bar Bat Mitzvah, Hebrew was only taught one day a week, and a lot of people have forgotten that that was so, it was taught, and if you took it seriously, you could learn how to read and how to do some simple translation. That group then vanished after a while. The people who had left the congregation were simply readmitted when they wanted to come back without any fuss.
Now this was...
And it wasn't a big group. We were not talking about a lot of people.
Really? I'm surprised. Then they made a lot of noise. I was in Philadelphia at that time. It was like America First kind of.
Well, it may have been big. I'm sure it was bigger in Philadelphia. but here, I don't have any exact figures. But my guess is that you're talking about maybe 20, 30 families, and out of a congregation of 2,000 families, that isn't going to make a tremendous amount of difference. But by not pushing them, it meant that they were not forced to form a separate congregation.
What did they do during the hiatus?
Forrest Idea did.
They did come back.
They came back. All of them have come back. And I know the names of some of the families, but I'm bothered by
And they came back after the fact, after the establishment.
Well, a good... Well, some of them, it took as long as 10 years to come back. You know, part of it, I think, is also that in some ways we have moved more slowly. And I've also put the brakes on occasionally in things that really don't make a great deal of difference, but could alienate segments of the congregation. So, and I think I mentioned that earlier, the use of Hebrew. So slowly we have incorporated considerably more Hebrew and done it in a way that it was almost invisible that this change happened. There were no big discussions at a religious, at worship committee meeting. Just did it. Nobody would ever question another paragraph, something else sung in Hebrew, okay. Or the, as I mentioned earlier, the Israeli flag, yeah. So at the appropriate moment, to just do it.
Do you have any other thing? Oh, I'm sorry. Did you have something?
What?
That was, we listened to that this afternoon. I haven't the slightest idea how much more is on the tape.
Let me look.
Any more?
I'll just also say this, that we've had a, of course, like every congregation, a committee structure for a great many things. And I've used that, but also limited the use of that, so that not by being autocratic about it, but if nothing was going to happen on the committee, I have not then tried to encourage that committee to meet excessively.
Okay, but
it's
the reverse of that. What role would the board have, or other kinds, reverse or not reverse, the bringing in new old kinds?
Well, first of all, you listen to people, and my effort has always been to keep these things from becoming debates, because when there's a debate, you've got clearly two sides of an issue, and people are then forced to take sides. So if you can simply listen to people and work out what you think is appropriate and then try it, and most of the time it'll be okay, and you won't have the confrontations.
Now, is it, yes.
Sure. How much, what you're saying then, you just don't write everything by the book. You try to do problems all on your own, whatever diplomatic or direct or indirect way. Not everything gets run across the board.
Most things that deal with education or religious life, or for that matter, social action, are never discussed by the board. They could be. But in the final analysis, first of all, what the Constitution says is that those matters are in the hands of the rabbi. Now, if the board wasn't with you, that constitutional statement wouldn't mean very much. So, by working with individuals and finding out what is on people's minds, what troubles them, what's going to work, what isn't going to work, you can bring about the changes. And we're realizing full well that sometimes you are leading and sometimes you're following. And sometimes you have a feeling that, all right, this is the feeling of the board, but the majority of the congregation is really not there. So let's just drag our feet a little bit on this one.
Now, with changes, these are national changes, I think. Pretty much.
Some are not, yeah, they're all national changes. And again, you have to see what direction you want to take locally, how fast or how slowly you want to go.
Are some Reformed congregations still more?
Yes, and others are much more traditional. A good many are also finding that a problem because if you start using a very large amount of Hebrew in the service, people feel, you know, I'm reading this, but it wasn't me. And that's the same with some of the other things. So it's pendulum continually swings back.
How about conservatives?
That's lean. Well, they've got serious problems because the right wing and the left wing are so far apart.
Oh, really?
And the right wing is virtually all